Okay, let us continue where we left off this morning. So we have looking at the sutta again, the two kinds of thought, and we have been looking at all the defiled thoughts so far, all the problematic ones and how to overcome those. And surprise, surprise, the next one is going to be the other side of the story, the good thoughts and how to deal with them and what happens in that case. The suttas are always kind of built up in this way. There's always kind of both sides of the story, so that's why they often seem quite repetitive and they do the same thing over and over here. So anyway, so let's see what the Buddha has to say about this, how to deal with the good kind of thoughts. So we continue the third paragraph. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood this thus. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi, from stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So here it is much more straightforward. So a thought of renunciation arises in you. A thought of renunciation is like a thought of giving up the sensory world, right? Giving all that up and moving towards something else, something more profound. And then, first of all, he knows a thought of renunciation, knows what that means. It actually strikes this strange, this idea of thought of renunciation. I think what it really means is a thought that is imbued with that quality. Because the same thing, thought of ill will is a thought that is imbued with ill will or with metta. Because sometimes the thought itself might just be, you know, might just be a verbalization. So I'm not entirely sure that's the ideal translation, but I'm sure you get the meaning here. So, and then of course you understand that this is there's no issue here, there's no problem. It doesn't lead to anyone suffering here. And in fact, it is the opposite. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads the way from nibbana, leads towards nibbana rather. So there you are, this is a positive kind of thought, the lead is in the right direction, the head in the right direction. So that is obviously one reason why these thoughts are so useful, because they actually take you in the right way. They abandon the defilement and they build up the positive qualities in the mind instead. So he says, he sees nothing to fear from these, even if he thinks about these things all day, all night. But if you think too much, you might tire the body. And then when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And so the idea here is that if you think too much, and I'm sure you all know what that means, if you think too much, you actually just feel tired, you won't go to sleep or whatever. And that's what happens. And here they make this distinction between body and mind, and I'm not entirely sure what that is meant to represent, but sometimes you just get physically tired as well, I suppose. That could be what is meant here. And then the mind kind of is affected by the body because it's physically tired. You also become mentally tired as well. These things probably often have a relationship to each other. I'm not sure if that is what is meant because the word body in Pali is used quite diversely, so it's a little bit unclear exactly what is going on here. But anyway, the main point is that you get tired, right? You get strained, and because of that, you are far from samadhi. So then, what do you do? You actually attain samadhi. This is what this whole thing about steadying the mind internally, quieting it down, bringing it to singleness, and stilling it. This is all about attaining samadhi. This is all about the jhanas, right? This is a standard formula. If you know your sutta as well, you know that this kind of phrasing that you have here, this is exactly used when somebody attains the jhana state. So basically here, he enters into a jhana state. And then what happens then? You relax, yeah. And then the mind doesn't become strained. And you come out again afterwards and you're full of energy, full of power when you come out afterwards. So this is one of the things I remember early days as I'm Ram. He talked about the jhanas a lot at the monastery here. And he always said, when you come out afterwards, you feel like a nuclear reactor here. This was what he said, yeah. Because you had so much energy, you kind of all tiredness is, you know, completely disappeared for a long time afterwards. So what we are seeing here, what is interesting about this, is that you're seeing the gradual movement of the path. It always starts off with abandoning the most difficult things first, the most harmful things, which in this case is the negative thinking. And that can, again, in turn, can be subdivided further, because the negative aspects of the mind and conduct, obviously there's many aspects to that. There's very coarse negative behavior. We have very strong ill will or very strong desire that drive you to do all kind of mad, crazy things. So this is kind of the first one. First of all, you abandon the bad stuff, specifically those mental aspects that make you break the precepts. Yeah, this is kind of the first where you start out, the really coarse negative qualities of mind. That's what you do first. Then you go to the middling ones. And the middling ones are like ordinary kind of ill will which arises every now and again, and desires and this kind of thing. And then you move on to the really refined things afterwards. And refined things are very subtle defilements. There's one nice sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya called the Earth Remover or something like that. And it's about how to refine gold. Yeah, and when you refine gold, this was how they refined gold, at least in the old days, you start off by taking out the really coarse, kind of gravel, that kind of thing, first of all. Then you take out the more refined things, the sand and that sort of stuff. Then you take out the really refined stuff, like the dust particles and that kind of thing. So you do it one stage by stage. And it tells you, refining the mind is exactly the same. You have to know where to start. You can't kind of sit down in samadhi straight away if you're breaking your five precepts, because your mind is too coarse. So you have to refine the mind out, just like you refine gold. Yeah, it's actually quite nice, because the idea of the mind is like gold, right? It's something very, very valuable if it is refined properly. And just like gold doesn't shine if it isn't refined, in the same way, the mind doesn't shine unless it has been refined. Exactly the same kind of principle there. So you bring the gold out of the mind. Yeah, that's kind of the idea here. So you have to do it stage-wise, and you have to know what is the right thing to do at this particular point. Otherwise, it's not going to work properly. And this is why one of the reasons why you have this gradual training, because then you will kind of see, obviously we have to do all of these steps, but it gives you some idea where you can improve your practice. So then your meditation will improve down the line, and also your insight and all the other stuff as a consequence of that. So this is what is shown here. First of all, you abandon the bad thoughts. The bad thoughts are already abandoned in stages. The counterpart to that is to develop the good thoughts. And then when you have good thoughts in the mind, you sit down and meditate, you just feel good, you wish everyone in the whole world well, right? You feel really good about yourself. That's kind of the idea. And then, when you do that, you realize you have to abandon the good thoughts as well to make the mind absolutely peaceful. And that is then one step higher. And you have to follow that sequence. There is no shortcut for that. You have to do things in that way. Sometimes people get it completely wrong, and they have all kind of bad thinking. They just want to shut it all out. They want to get rid of all the bad thoughts. And then meditate, and they go completely nuts, because if you have too many defilements in the mind and you try to meditate too hard, you literally can end up going crazy. Yeah, this is one of the problems. You have to do things in the right way. Otherwise, you go on retreat for 2 weeks in solitude, and then all of these bad thoughts are going to really come and haunt you and give you a really hard time. So that's what you do. And then you go into jhanas, and you relax, and you become the nuclear generator, and then after that you come out again, and then you're ready for the, for insights and all this other kind of stuff, once you have that special power. So, that is how the sequence goes. The most important thing here, again, is all about the overcoming of the bad qualities. The further up the path you go, the easier it tends to be. Yes, the hardest part is almost at the beginning, to overcome the bad stuff. And then things become easier, brighter, more beautiful as you go down the line. Okay, so then we have, that is the thought of renunciation. Then we have the same thing for the thoughts of non-ill will and non-harming. It's exactly the same paragraph again. I'll read it out because it's nice. I like to repeat stuff, but hope you don't mind it. Personally, I quite enjoy it, actually. Every time I read it, it goes in a bit deeper, you know how. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, with effort, the thought of non-ill will, or if you like, a thought of metta, thought of loving kindness, arose in me, a thought of non-cruelty, a thought of non-harming, or a thought of compassion, arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of non-harming has arisen in me. It does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nirvana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So the same idea again, as we saw in the previous paragraph. There's one little point here which actually is a little bit interesting. It's interesting to me anyway, not sure if it's interesting for you, but I'll tell you anyway, just in case it might be interesting for you. And this is this idea here of the word thought. The word thought you see here with excessive thinking and all of this. It says, if I ponder upon this thought, the Pali word for that is vitakka. And so vitakka is one of these words that is used throughout the suttas to mean thinking, the thinking mind. And what is interesting is that word is also used in the formula for the first jhana. The first jhana also you have vitakka. Yeah, so then the interesting question arises, does that mean that in the first jhana you're actually thinking? What kind of stillness of the mind is it if you're thinking? Is it really stillness at all? And this is kind of one of those things that if you, you know, if you want to discuss sutta, this is kind of the sort of thing people discuss around the world. What is the meaning of vitakka? What do you do? Does it mean different things outside and inside of jhana? What is going on here? Can you kind of think yourself into jhana? That kind of stuff. And what is interesting about this sutta here also exists in a version translated into Chinese. This is what I was saying before about having parallel versions of the same sutta in different languages, translated into different languages. And this, all of these things you see here is almost exactly the same as the Pali. One of the reasons why I reversed the simile before with the other paragraph is because in the Chinese version of the sutta, the simile actually comes before the other paragraph. These are the kind of things that often can go wrong when you translate things orally, that things can be turned around like that. So I changed it around according to the Chinese translation. But what is interesting here is that when it is translated into Chinese, when vitakka is used in the first paragraph here to talk about you are thinking too much, then they use one Chinese character here. Later on in the sutta, they talk about the jhanas. And when they're talking about vitakka inside the jhana, they use a different kind of Chinese character here. Yeah, so according to the Chinese, what they are saying is that vitakka has two different meanings. Vitakka, when it's outside of a jhana context, it actually means thinking or pondering or whatever it is. Within the jhana context, it means something else. It still means something to do with the movement of the mind, but it does not mean thinking in the ordinary way. This is one of those things that if you know your sutra as well, the kind of stuff that you argue when you argue with people about these things, these are the kind of arguments you use to resolve these kind of issues. Because these are actually very important things, because whether you understand what the jhana is and whether you don't understand what it is, it actually means all the difference for practicing properly. If you don't get the full jhana experience, it means that you haven't really suppressed, or not suppressed is the wrong word, you haven't really abandoned the hindrances properly. If you don't get that full experience, the chances that you will get the full insight and go all the way to the end of the path is also very slim. Yeah, so it's actually quite important to interpret these things in the right way. Otherwise, you might never actually get there to the end of this path. So these things actually matter. It may seem a bit far away from where what most of you do, as far as suttas are concerned, but actually, if you're really interested in these things, they actually matter a little bit. Anyway, just out of interest for you. So now we have the simile again, just like we had last time. And this time it goes just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops had been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, it was need for me only to be mindful that those qualities were there. Yeah, so no more poking and tapping on the cows is required. Now you can start to relax much more. You just sit down in the shade of a tree. It's like sitting on a meditation cushion, I suppose. And you just look, observe the mind, and you ensure that the mind stays within its bounds, which is the good kind of thinking. That is, of course, the point that is going on here. So all you have to do now is to be mindful. You don't have to do very much else, because the mind is already in the right space. So, and then we have the other paragraph coming again. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, upon thoughts of non-harming, he has abandoned the thought of harming to cultivate the thought of non-harming, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-harming. Yeah, isn't that kind of nice? Imagine your mind always inclining towards metta, always inclining towards compassion, always inclined to giving up kind of all the coarse happinesses of the world and move towards the refined ones. You can see how easy things become at that point. Of course, still, you may have occasionally negative thoughts, but whenever you sit down to meditate, the baseline is always friendliness, kindness, and all these beautiful qualities. You always come back to that again. This, of course, is the idea here, to bring the mind around to that point. The habits become so strong that you can't avoid the metta anymore. Isn't that kind of nice? You can't avoid having metta. Yeah, it's kind of imbued in you, it's part of your personality, part of your psychological makeup. You are, literally, you are a blob of metta walking around in this world, yeah? Kind of a nice thought, and kind of full of compassion and kindness for people. So, and it's also very protective in a way at the same time. You feel kind of protected inside of yourself if you have a lot of these good qualities, if you do them in the right way. And you feel more in charge of your own emotions, etc., as we talked about before. So, that is the making that into a habit of the mind. And then we have the very last little bit here that I have just added in just for fun, I suppose. So it says here that tireless energy was aroused in me. Unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind stilled and unified. And this is the point here. When you have abandon all the negative qualities of the mind, and especially when you go into space of samadhi, right, you get this energy, tireless energy, the energy that seems to be there, no kind of end to it anymore. It's kind of bubbling up inside. You don't have to make any effort. It's just a natural aspect of your mind again. It's part of this energy that is always there. Unremitting mindfulness. Unremitting, it means that it doesn't change, right? It doesn't slacken off. It doesn't become less. It's not a very common word. Not the ideal translation, I would say, because it's the word that is too specialized, but it means like mindfulness, which is established, which doesn't slack, which is always there. Yeah? So mindfulness becomes strong. You are really aware. All the bad thoughts have gone. You feel good. You're enjoying the present moment because you feel good about yourself and everything. Yeah? So mindfulness is really strong as a consequence. Body is tranquil and untroubled. You feel at peace. You sit down, your body feels solid, and you don't have all this agitation and restlessness and all of that kind of stuff, and your mind becomes concentrated. No, it does not become concentrated, it becomes still, I apologize there, and then unified there. There you can see a bit of that same thing we saw with the Bhujangas before. Yeah, you have the energy, you have the mindfulness. In the Bhujangas, it was the reverse, mindfulness first, then energy. Here is energy first, mindfulness. These things revolve around each other. And then tranquility, and then ending up with samadhi as a consequence. And after this, this particular sutta then goes on to the jhanas, as the Buddha says, then he sits down and practices the jhanas, right? This is what the Buddha did before his awakening, was practicing the jhana sense. And then from that, he had all the insights, the tevijas, that we were talking about before, the past life and all this kind of experience that happened after that. Okay. So there you are. That's the Gvela Vitaka Sutta. And now let us move on to the next sutta. The next sutta is a very practical one. And we are still dealing with right effort on the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is a very practical sutta on how to deal with ill will and negativity in the mind. Yeah, this is the main purpose of the sutta. Very, very down to earth. So far, what we have been saying is that we have to deal with these negative thoughts. Yeah, and then this Vedavitaka Sutta has shown us that the way to deal with them is through using wisdom rather than willpower. Yeah, and it has given us some indications of how to do that, how to think about the situation so that it actually gets rid of these things. Now, this is even more specific. Yeah? This gives us very specific instructions on how to think to overcome things like ill will. This is kind of really getting down to the real kind of very practical part here of the path. It's important to make it practical, right? It's important to make these things really explicit so that we know what we have to do. These are not the only way of dealing with thoughts of ill will, but this is the main way it is explained in the sutta, how to do this. And this sutta is actually given by Venerable Sariputta. And he was considered the Buddha's right-hand monk. He was the wisest monk in the Sangha after the Buddha himself. And the Buddha often said that if the Buddha was to pass away, then Venerable Sariputta would kind of take over the teaching activity, and he would keep on rolling the wheel of the Dhamma in the world, because he had, it seems, almost the same ability to teach as the Buddha himself. That's what seems to be saying there. So he is the Buddha's right-hand monk. So when you see, sometimes you see a statue of the Buddha, let's see, and usually you have on either side of the Buddha, usually you have Mahamoggallana on one side, and then you have Venerable Sariputta on the other side. So when you have the Buddha in the middle, you would have then Venerable Sariputta on the right side, and Mahamoggallana on the other side. And the way you can tell the difference between them is that Venerable Sariputta, he sits like this, something like that. This is how he sits, yeah? And Venerable Mahamoggallana sits like this, next to the Buddha. That's the difference. And you can actually, now you know, right? You can tell. Next time you go to a shrine, you know what you look for. Little kind of thing. So. Anyway, let's see what happens. So there the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus, or monks, friends monks. Friend, those monks replied, the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a monk should entirely root, monk, nun, layperson, anyone, aliens, whoever it is, should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So resentment here just means like ill will and negativity. Yeah, so that's kind of the same word really. And here you have five types of people. And the thing here is that these five types of people, they include everybody. Everybody is part of this. Yeah. So here you go from the person with the worst qualities to the person with the kind of most saintly qualities. So if you have somebody in your life that you really don't, you know, you find it very hard to get along with, unfortunately, according to this, even that person, you have to find a way of not having ill will. You cannot say, I will have metta towards everybody in the world except this one person. Yeah, that is not the Buddha, not the Buddhist way of doing things. Everybody has to be included there. So, and this is what they said, and actually it's quite nice, right? It means that it is possible to do that. It's actually possible to have a sense of metta or compassion and to give up ill will for anyone. If we do it in the right way, we think about things in the right way, we perceive in the right way, it can be done. And, surprise, surprise, actually it is not that hard. We tend to think these things are very difficult, but actually it isn't that difficult. It's all a matter of applying yourself, doing it again and again. Using your wisdom. We all have sufficient wisdom to do this kind of thing. So there's no such thing as I can't do it. Everybody can do this kind of thing. So just a matter of application. So this here is then the summary, right? Often the suttas are structured like this. You have a summary first, then you have the detailed exposition afterwards. So these were kind of, they were masters at doing things pedagogically. So it was kind of nicely set up for us to understand. So, let's look at the first person here. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. So the idea here is that people have many different qualities. Sometimes we have certain bad qualities, but other good qualities. Other times we have, you know, other bad qualities and some good qualities. So this thing kind of change all the time. In this particular case, they talk about bodily behavior which is good and verbal behavior which is bad. The other way around. I think the point is not so much to divide it into verbal and bodily. The point is just to show us that people have a complex. We have bad qualities and good qualities very often mixed with each other. And it's a matter of what we look at, right, that actually determines how we feel about that person. It's the ability to look in the right place that really matters here. We have this nice simile here that actually illustrates this very, very beautifully here. The rag-robed bhikkhu, these kind of rag-robed bhikkhus, these are the kind of the bhikkhus who don't get robes. This is a ready-made robe, right? So this is not a rag robe. Actually, there's a few patches on it, but anyway. So the idea is that in those days, if you were really kind of an ascetic monk, you would walk around in India and you would find rags like in the roadside or outside of shops, or you would go to the charnel ground. The charnel ground is where they would burn the corpses, and when a corpse was thrown in the charnel ground, it would still have some cloth on it, so we'd take the cloth off the corpse, and then use that in your robe. But you have to be pretty quick, because the corpse becomes pretty disgusting very, very quickly, so you have to do it very soon, otherwise it becomes terrible. There was a story about that in the Vinayapitaka. The Vinayapitaka is full of this kind of crazy stories. And this is it's exactly this kind of situation. A rag-robed bhikkhu, he goes to the charnel ground, right, and then he sees this fresh corpse, really, really fresh, maybe still a little bit warm, right, because of it, very fresh, has all this nice cloth, it takes up all the cloth of the corpse. And then the corpse kind of comes to life again. This is actually the story in the vineyard. This is kind of a crazy story, isn't it? The corpse comes to life and it says, "Don't take my cloth." Right? This is what the corpse says. This is like, I'm not sure if it's a zombie or if kind of the ghost comes back in or what happens. And the vicar gets a bit worried, gets a bit concerned, starts kind of walking fast back to his duty. And the corpse comes after him, right? Like a zombie. So this is kind of, I think, the original zombie, where all the zombie movies got the kind of inspiration from this particular story here. And anyway, he kind of rushes back, slams the door, gets into his cutie, his little hunter, slams the door, and just the corpse collapses on the ground outside. Right? He's just okay here. It's weird, isn't it? This story, as you find in the suit, are really, really strange sometimes. This is from the Vinaya, by the way, here. And the reason that we have that story here is that I think the Buddha says that you should not take a cloth. If the corpse is too fresh, you shouldn't take the cloth. You should wait till the corpse is cold or something like that. Then you can kind of take the cloth off the body of the corpse. This is the kind of rules we have, right, in the Vinaya? It's very interesting to be a monastic, right? You have all this kind of weird stuff there. So this is what the rag robe bhikkhus are like. And I actually had one of these rag robes when I was a young monk. I kept on patching my robe until there was nothing left at all of the original cloth. It was just a patch thing here. And it's quite cool. It was kind of multicolored, right? I was wandering around the world looking like this kind of a Christmas tree almost. Very, very interesting here. But actually quite nice because it's very valueless. It's kind of just a piece of rags that got walking around. It's actually quite nice. So anyway, so in those days you had more of those, because in those days cloth was very valuable, much more valuable than it is nowadays. So monks would do this, and they would find rags here and there. And when they find the rag, you press it down with your left foot, and you spread it out with your right foot, right? The idea is you get an idea of the cloth, what are the good parts, what are the bad parts, all that kind of stuff. And this is just like if you have a person, you can imagine you kind of spread the person out in your mind and you see all the qualities of that person, from the really bad ones to the middling ones to the really good ones over there. In the same way, as you spread out the cloth, you spread the qualities of that person out in your mind's eye. You see what is going on. And then when you have spread it out like that, you tear off the intact section. Yeah, you tear off, and what do you do with the other stuff? You chuck it out, because it's rubbish. In the same way, you have all these qualities, so you kind of tear it down the middle. You take the good qualities, and all those bad qualities, you throw them out, because they're rubbish. They are bad news. They're not going to help you to go anywhere. So you throw them out. And then he takes the intact section, and takes it away with him. In the same way, all those good qualities that are there that you have seen in your mind's eye, you take them. You take them inside your mind. You take them into your heart. And you carry those with you as you walk into the future. Yeah? And this is how it's like a development of perception that you're seeing here. You keep on developing the perception of the good qualities in somebody else. And if you keep on developing that, after a while, that's all you can see. Because you remind yourself all the time of the good qualities. And when you see the bad quality, you just think, rubbish, I don't want to see that. And you kind of just chuck it out. And you carry those good qualities with you. And then whenever a thought of ill will or whatever is about to arise in your mind, you go into that little shelf in your mind, and you pick down that perception of this particular person, the good qualities of this person, pick it out, quickly insert it into your mind, and you abandon the negative quality as a consequence. It works, it works, and you can try it on a retreat like this, because when you live so closely together as we do now, there's bound to be other people that sometimes irritate you. This is life, right? People do something that we think they shouldn't be doing, they think they should be doing it, but we think they shouldn't be doing it. And little irritations always happen when we're very close to other people. So this is an opportunity to remind yourself that the people you are with here are wonderful people. These are the people who really want to make a difference in the world, who want to be kind, who want to help others or help themselves. What a wonderful thing it is to be able to share, a few days on a retreat with people like this. And so that is what matters, right? Whether they make a tiny little mistake, they're too noisy in the door or whatever it is, it's nothing. What matters is this big picture that they're actually doing something really worthwhile with their lives. So that you bring that big picture off the shelf and you kind of replace that and you say, forget about that tiny little thing. I'm just being silly. Why am I focusing on that? And the reason why you're focusing on that is just because of habit. That's the reason why you're focusing on those little things. So you chuck out, you try to get rid of those habits and you replace them with the other picture and stay there. And that is what this means. This is how you do that. And it's not that hard. The reason why it is hard is, again, because of habits. But if you keep on doing this, and all of these things take training, they take perseverance, they take commitment, but if you keep on doing it, eventually the day comes when it actually becomes easy. So do try this out, and do it in particular with those people in your life that you find are a little bit difficult, not too difficult, but people you can see both good and bad qualities in, especially those who have a lot of good qualities and a few bad ones. Yeah, then you can use this kind of technique of almost like substituting one perception, one way of thinking for another. And this way, abandon these things. Now, sometimes people say that this is being unrealistic. How can you just look at the good qualities in somebody? Everybody has bad qualities. Yes, we're not really being realistic about people. And I don't want to lie to myself. I don't want to pretend that somebody has all good qualities when in fact they don't. But remember that the world as it is, there is no way of knowing what is going on in other people. There is no absolutely realistic picture of somebody else. All we have is our own idea of what somebody else is like. If you take one person, and then two different people are going to describe that person, they often describe that person very, very differently, even if they may know him reasonably well. One person might see all the bad qualities because he is an enemy. Another person is his friend, so he sees all the good qualities. They're actually describing the same person, but it sounds like they're describing two different people. Which one is right? Both are right. None are right, right? There is no subjective reality, or rather, there is precisely a subjective. There is an objective reality, which is absolutely true. Yeah? So the whole idea that I must be realistic is just, it doesn't work. There is no such thing as being realistic about other people. It's only our perceptions of them that exist. And apart from our perceptions, there is no reality, really. Remember, one of the points here, of course, is the whole Buddhist idea of non-self, that somebody is always changing. Yeah, so one day we have one quality, the next day we have a different quality, and then 2 years later we are completely different again because we've practiced in the Buddhist path really well, so we're kind of improving in good qualities, all these kind of things. Which one is the real us? Is it the one when you are on the bad day, you are kind of negative and kind of grumpy? Or is it on the good day when you are kind of, you know, friendly with everyone and kind of saying good morning to everyone or whatever it is? Which is the real you? Well, there isn't any real you there. All of these things together are kind of who you are. But that also changes over time. So in the end, we have to give up this idea that there is a real objective reality, that we can actually be objective about things. So once we realize that there is no such thing as being realistic, that doesn't work, there is another way to look at this. And that is to ask ourselves, what is most advantageous for us to look? How should we look upon other people in such a way that it encourages our practice, that it matures our practice, and it actually takes us in the right direction? Not just us, but also makes us more useful for other people at the same time. Yeah. So what is actually more advantageous in terms of happiness, in terms of contentment, and all of these kind of things? That is the real question that we should ask ourselves. So forget about this being realistic thing. Instead, ask yourself, what works? What takes you forward on the Buddhist path? And what takes you forward on the Buddhist path is always looking for the good qualities in somebody else. What actually is very nice about it is that it takes you forward when you look at that. But very often when we focus on the good qualities in other people, it also encourages those good qualities in that person. This is one of the things that you kind of see sometimes. If you always give that positive reinforcement and you look for the good qualities in other people, they tend to show you those good qualities back. Yeah. So it has many advantages in many different spheres of life, this way of doing things. So this is what it is about. But again, remember that it takes a commitment, it takes practice, it takes time to kind of develop these things. But it is as simple as this. And if you keep on doing that, eventually you will be able to change your attitude towards individuals. Sometimes it's good to start with individuals, with a certain person, and then you can take others afterwards, and you can kind of get rid of some of those difficult situations in your life. Okay, so that is how resentment or ill will should be abandoned towards that kind of person. So let's have a look at the next one. and how friends should resentment be removed towards a person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure. Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion we should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here, it's exactly the same as in the previous example. Somebody has some good qualities and some bad ones. Here they are slightly different. But here the only real difference here is really the simile. And this simile kind of brings out a few additional points, I think, about how this is to be regarded. So here the pond is a simile for the person. So the person is the pond. And this pond is covered with algae and water plants. These are like the negative qualities in that person. This is like the impure verbal behavior. So then this other man comes, right? You are afflicted and oppressed by the heat. This means like you are afflicted by ill will and negativity. You feel hot. This is what ill will feels like. It feels hot, right? It kind of gives you a sense of energy, but heat is kind of energy. And you are oppressed by this. In other words, you recognize that this is bad. You want to get rid of this. And you are weary and thirsty. Often ill will leads to a bit of tiredness after a while. You are thirsty, looking for something to quench that heat inside. You are parched. Parched means like you've got a little bit too much sun. That's what parched means, essentially. And then because you do that, and you recognize you want to get rid of that ill will, you plunge into that pond. You sweep away the algae and the water plants with your hands. You sweep away those bad qualities, just as in the previous one. And then you drink with your cupped hands. You drink in all the good qualities that are found underneath the algae and the water plants. You drink them on board. You imbibe them, take them inside. And then, of course, once you have drunk them, you carry them with you. Into the future, wherever you're going. This is kind of the idea. You cool down, right? Just like water is cool and it cools you down. In exactly the same way, you drink in those good qualities and they cool you down. You get rid of the anger and the negativity as a consequence. It's nice simile, this one. And it kind of gives you an idea how this works. You take those on board and it cools you down as a consequence. So that's all of that. The person who has some good qualities and some bad ones. Now we come to the person who has just a tiny bit of good qualities. Just a little bit of good qualities. And there are not so many good ones, so we'll see what we do in this particular case. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle, but if I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. On that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have a person who is bad, says bad things, does bad things, maybe not all the time, but at least often enough that you can kind of become known for that. But still, you gain from time to time, you gain the opening of the mind and placidity of the mind. So what does that mean? And what that means is basically just opening of the mind here is the opposite word from what we use for the hindrances. The Pali word for the hindrances is nivarana, and this word here is vivarana. Vivarana means the opposite of nivarana, so it means the opening of the mind, the freedom of the mind that comes from not having any hindrances in the mind. Yeah? That's roughly what it means. Or at least a lot of hindrances being abandoned. And placidity of the mind, again, is this idea of placid. When the mind, when water is placid, it's like flat. Yeah, flat water, but it's absolutely no wind. It's placid. The same with the mind. When the mind isn't ruffled or stirred up by defilements, it is placid and even inside. You have a sense of great evenness inside of you. Not this kind of ruffledness that happens when you get wind and all kind of problems. So this is a person who, even though they have bad qualities of body and speech, they still gain this stillness of the mind sometimes. Yeah, and sometimes people say, it's unfair. I have been practicing all these practices. I've been speaking the right way, doing the right acts. Still don't get any samadhi. And here comes this scallywag, right? This dodgy character, does so many bad things. And they get this kind of thing. What's going on here? Is this possible? Why is there such difference? And of course, the reality is that as human beings, or any being, we are so complicated. We come from this distant past and past lives with all kind of conditioning coming with us. And because the conditioning is so complicated, that conditioning expresses itself in a very complicated way in this life. So maybe somebody has done a lot of good things in the past, and they still carry with them some of that goodness into the present life. And that is why they're able to become still and peaceful in meditation or whatever. But for some reason, they have come under a bad influence, and they're doing bad things. Soon enough, they will also lose that stillness of the mind because of that. Whereas other people, maybe the majority of people, we come from a more mixed background, or we come from a background where we have been doing maybe some bad things. And because of that, even though we're practicing well in this life, it takes a while before that practice establishes a really peaceful and settled mind. Yeah, so, and this, of course, what this whole path is about, is to enable us to establish that peaceful mind so that meditation becomes possible as a consequence. The longer you practice Sila, the longer you practice all these good qualities, the more your mind will settle down in the right way. It's about keeping going, persevering. That is how these things eventually come about. And as you persevere, also deepen that Sila. So it's not really unfair. It looks unfair, and people kind of complain, sometimes in jest, in joke by joke, of course, but actually, this is just the complexity of things. Please don't think that if somebody gets good meditation that they're actually not a very likable person. Don't think it's okay not to be likable and kind of be a kind of dodgy character, because then you will get it all wrong and you will go further away from the goal if you do that. It's so easy to come to the wrong conclusions, right? It's sometimes so hard to see all these causalities and things. So you have to be very, very careful. You have to have appamada. You have to be circumspect when you look at other people and you come to conclusions. So there's a little bit of water in a puddle. So this is like a small amount of good qualities. There's a tiny bit of good qualities. So because of that little bit of water in the puddle, again, you are afflicted and oppressed by the heat, you are angry and upset, you are weary, tired, and all of these kind of things. And you want to cool down. So you see the little bit of water, you see the little bit of good quality there. And you think, if I drink those up, I will cool down. But here you have to be very careful. If you use your hands or a vessel, you will stir it up. You will disturb it. If you have to look at those good qualities very narrowly. If you look a little bit to the right or a little bit to the left, you will see all the bad qualities. You have to focus very narrowly on that little bit of water that is there. And then you get down on all fours. I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean in terms of the simile here, but I guess it means you are very careful, you're kind of very steady, and you suck it up like a cow. You focus narrowly on those qualities, and you imbibe them, you drink them up, and you cool down as a consequence of that. The anger goes, and you feel at ease, and you feel relaxed again. And what is interesting about this is to the extent to which the Buddha, or in this case, when the Mahasari Buddha, the extent to which they go to focus on the good qualities. Yeah, even if there's just a little bit of good qualities there, this says we should actually try to focus on those things. In the next passage, we come to the person who has no good qualities whatsoever, right? A really, really bad person. And in that case, we have to use a different strategy, because we can't use the strategy of focusing on the good qualities, because they aren't there. And that's when you use compassion instead. Compassion is the right way, attitude there. But here, even if there's just a tiny bit of good qualities, we try our very best to focus on those good qualities. So why is it? What is the point of going so far in trying to focus on the good qualities? Why do we take it to this extent? What is the point of that? And the point of that, I think, is that when we look at the good qualities, it's like a metta practice. Yeah. And if you practice metta, there is very few danger that you will go astray, that you will go the wrong way. Metta is always positive. Seeing the good in other people can never be wrong. It's always a positive thing. It's being friendly, it's being kind. There's all these good qualities in that. The problem, if you start to use compassion, compassion is often has to do with seeing the suffering in other people. And when you see the suffering, you get this feeling, oh, may they be free of suffering, all these kind of things. But when you go to the idea of suffering, it is very easy to go a little bit astray and to feel perhaps a bit sad or a bit, oh, so much suffering in the world. Yeah, I know people tell me this all the time. Oh, yeah, I focus on the suffering to have compassion, but I lose all my energy because, oh, I feel so kind of sad about seeing all the suffering in the world. I think this is a danger with compassion, that it can more easily go astray, more easily go the wrong way. Metta, you can never really go the wrong way. Seeing the good qualities is never a problem. If you know your sutta as well, you will know that when we have the Brahma Viharas, right, the four divine abidings, metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, or even-mindedness, the four, the first one is always metta. Yeah, and as I said before, everything in the sutta is structured. There is a reason why metta is first. It is first because it is the first one we should develop. That's why it is there. Once that is developed, then you move on to karuna and compassion. So metta is kind of crucial. There's very little danger with metta because you're just focusing on the good qualities. Always makes you feel good. Always enhances your relationship with other people. Has all these positive benefits. That is the person with only a few good qualities. And then we come to the interesting person, the person who has no good qualities. Yeah. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the same highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breaking up of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, even in hell. And this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So, the idea here is that if somebody has all bad qualities, then we should have compassion for them. Yeah, so if somebody is very difficult in your life, and somebody is very hard to deal with, compassion is always the right attitude. Why is that? Because somebody who is absolutely full of bad qualities, they are heading in the wrong direction. They are creating enormous amounts of suffering for themselves. Everybody in this world wants to create happiness for oneself. We all want to create happiness for ourselves. Nobody wants to have more suffering. We've got enough problems already. Even as a monk, you have enough problems. Let alone, I'm sure, in lay life, probably even more. So, enough of that. We all want to move towards happiness. And here is a person who is actually creating suffering for themselves. They obviously think, that they're creating happiness. Everybody thinks whenever we act, we think that we're doing the right thing. So we think that we're creating happiness one way or another. But we are deluded. We don't know what we're doing. So this person here is like, have no idea what's happening. They are blind. They're walking around in darkness, deluded as to the nature of how the mind works, how happiness arises in the world. And if somebody is creating suffering for themselves, thinking that they are creating happiness, wanting happiness, desiring happiness, because everybody wants happiness, then of course you have compassion. They have no idea what they're doing. They are being their own enemy by creating happiness for themselves. Just like you don't want happiness for your enemy, in this way you're actually creating misery for yourself, as if you don't want to create happiness for yourself in the future. If you have a lot of bad qualities, remember that the consequence of that can be really, really bad, according to the Buddhist teachings. And of course, that is borne out by the whole idea of rebirth. You feel already bad enough in this life. If you do bad stuff, you all know what you feel like if you do something bad. And if you compound that a lot, it makes, after a while, we feel really miserable. And then it gets even worse when we take into account the idea of rebirth. So the beauty of this, of remembering it, the stupidity and the silliness of people who want to be happy but actually create suffering for themselves, the beauty of that is that when somebody is difficult in your face, in your company, right? It's so easy to think about yourself, oh no, why do I have to deal with this person? So much suffering to deal with this person. So the idea here is to turn the tables. And instead of focusing on yourself, you only have to be in the company of this person for a short while, then you're off again and you do your own thing. Yeah, but this person, they will actually have to reap the consequences of this behavior for a long, long, long time into the future. So instead of worrying so much about ourselves, we're turning the table and looking at the other person instead. Instead of feeling sorry for ourselves, which is fair enough, because we are closer to ourselves than anyone else. But by doing this, you're turning the table around. And instead of having this kind of self-concern, which sometimes is very small and very narrow and kind of painful to be concerned about ourselves, instead, we have compassion for the other person instead. It's very beautiful when that happens, because it opens up your mind. It allows your mind to kind of expand and take in other people. And we don't have that self-concern anymore, which is narrow and small. You allow yourself to have this expansive mind instead. Turning the tables around, understanding where the real problem lies. Yes, there's a little bit of suffering for you, but for the other person, it is really a major problem. And this is possible to do, right? This is not impossible. It's all a matter of perception, all a matter of developing that perception on yourself. And then one day, when you need that perception, take it down and use it to counteract that ill will or that problem that arises in your mind. So that is the idea of dealing with people who are really difficult. One, I think, point here that maybe I can make very briefly is the idea that to remember that this is not actually, we're not talking here about what people actually are like, because this is impossible to know. What we're talking about is our own perceptions of other people. So we perceive somebody as really bad, right? Or we perceive somebody as having mixed qualities, or we perceive somebody as being really saintly, or whatever it is. And it's important to remember that this is only your perception. It's not actually reality. Because when you remember that it's only your perception, and that it's uncertain what the person actually is like, it means that you allow more flexibility for that person to change, and in the future to actually see other qualities in that person. Too often we kind of decide this person is bad, okay, out, don't have anything more to do with them. But when you understand that this is just your view of the situation, you give that person the opportunity to change and to become a better person. So this is actually very beautiful, because sometimes if you block somebody off, you decide forever and after this person is bad, it means that even if that person becomes better, even if they do change, even if they have good qualities, you won't see them. You're kind of trapping that person in that bad position. Yeah, but this other way allows people to change. It allows people, you're kind of opening up your heart to them, giving them this opportunity to change and to be different. And then that other person will feel that. It makes it easier for them to change as well when other people actually allow that. Otherwise, they also feel trapped as a bad person or whatever. So remember, these things are all our personal perceptions. Nothing to do with them. None of these things are absolute in any way. That is it for now. So all of this is about how to use our wisdom, right? How to use our wisdom power to be able to overcome anger and ill will and all of these kind of things. And the main point here is basically always to remember, if there is good qualities in somebody, always search them out to the best of your ability and focus on those good qualities. And as you do that, hopefully you can abandon a lot of the ill will as a result of that. Okay, that is it. And we'll see you again this evening at 7:30.